The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Monday Space Show program. Great to be back live, and thank you all for tuning in. So we're going to do a 90-minute program with our two guests today, and we're going to rush through the announcements, and there will be no break because we have to adjourn on time. We will not go over, so we're going to maximize our talk time. If you would like to call and talk to either or both of our guests, Dr. John Jurist or Dr. Chaim Ben-Arroya, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. You can also email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we're trademark copyrighted, and you do have permission to download the shows and pass them around and share them. But please, nothing commercial, no editing of the programs, no private YouTube channels. Please don't do written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. And also remember, that we are a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation.org, and this program only exists because of your generous support, and we thank all of you who have supported us and who will be supporting us in the future. You can find out more about One Giant Leap Foundation.org at their website, One Giant Leap Foundation.org. And again, if you pay U.S. taxes, you do get a tax deduction because it is a federal 501c3. If you're paying California taxes, you also get a California tax deduction. And we certainly do appreciate your support. And that's pretty much it for announcements. As I said, I wanted to skip through them. Well, I do have the one announcement I want to continue to make, and that is that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. You can get much more information about this fine organization, Secure World Foundation, by visiting their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And our guests today are Dr. John Jurist and Dr. Chaim Ben-Arroya. And you know each of them. They're frequent guests on the program. Dr. Ben-Arroya is a mechanical engineering professor at Rutgers University. And Dr. Jurist is the guru for the Space Show on many different science, technology, engineering, human factors, space medicine types of subjects. And their bios are all over the website and our archives. As I said, both are on the program very, very often. Great grammar there. And we don't need to read their bios. We need to get them talking. So, as you recall, several months ago, both guests were on, and we attempted a couple of programs to come up with the most desirable space policy ever. And boy, was that a struggle. And the three of us have been struggling to write some op-ed pieces on what we believe space policy should be like. And actually, the three of us are pretty much on the same page, but I've been the biggest holdout in writing the articles because, number one, I'm not sure they do any good, given that there is a proliferation of really great space policy ideas and suggestions from many, many qualified people out there, and they seem to fall on deaf ears, and I really didn't want ours to fall on deaf ears, and I thought that was probably going to be the likely outcome. So I've been the main dragger here. John, as well as Chaim, have been much more aggressive and forthright in putting these articles together. But we finally did get something together. The drafts of two approaches that we're taking are on the blog. So one of them is an op-ed, and all of these are drafts. We're intending to refine them based on input on this show and input from listeners who hear the program on archives, and then post comments or feedback on the blog. But we are planning to update and finalize both and then go for publication and distribution. So one of them is an op-ed about the United States is at a crossroads. And the other one is not really an op-ed. It's an open letter to people in government, from the president all the way down to the House of Representatives. And it's about we'll tell you what it's about in a few minutes. But there are two different approaches. The open letter will also be published, but it likely will be mailed to people on the relevant Senate and House committees, as well as their staffers. But both articles, or letters, as you may wish to call them, are designed for op-ed type of publication online or in print. And we do welcome your feedback, criticism, critiques, hate mail, positive ideas, strong suggestions. Just put them on the blog. Don't send them to me. And if you make that mistake and do send them to me, I'm letting you know right away that they're going to be published in full, without any editing, on the blog under your name. So it's much better if you do it. We're all devoted here to a public and a transparency process on refining these letters and our ideas. And so that's what this show is all about. It is about the two op-ed letters. They're, again, on the blog for you to read. One of them is titled An Open Letter to Our Government, and the other one is The United States at a Crossroads. So I'm going to turn the program over to John and Chaim and collect their thoughts on our approach and what we believe policy should be. And John, why don't we start with you and your 2 cents worth, please.
Are you there?
Must be sent in rather than hate mail.
Hold on, John.
From the opinions that you sent.
John, start over. We had a glitch and we lost the first 20 seconds of what you were saying. So start over again, okay?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, now we've got you back.
Okay. I'd prefer that instead of sending hate mail type comments, that people send in constructive criticisms, obviously. But having said that, I think that it's unrealistic for us to expect much in the way of expansion of government spending, given the current economy, on human spaceflight or uncrewed spaceflight as well. I think it's more likely than not that space spending will remain at on the order of 0.5% of the federal budget for the near-term foreseeable future. And then after that, the only thing that would allow an increase is, number one, decent leadership on the part of our national leaders in defining some goals and some programs. And the second is to get the economy moving again so that there's more discretionary spending that is at least potentially available to invest in space flight, space commerce, and technology.
Listeners, let me say, and when you read the two items, we did not specify this or that specific program or this specific goal. For example, we didn't say we have to go to the moon or we have to do humans to Mars or we have to reinstate the Mars planetary program. We're non-committal on a specific project or venture. We're very forceful on overall constructive policies. Chaim, your comments and introductory comments for us?
I guess I would add that following what John said, that not to expect more than a 0.5% budget of the gross domestic product for NASA. I would also add that I would not expect any changes in any of the dismantling of the manned space program and the Mars probes from this administration. So I guess what we're doing here with these two letters it's laying the groundwork for a possible change in administration or for something down the road, because the current administration has made it very clear that not only are they not interested in manned space to the moon or Mars, they're also not really interested in scientific probes to Mars or elsewhere in the solar system. So we certainly have certain boundaries that we can't transcend, no matter how eloquent our letters may or may not be.
One of the other focuses, listeners, on our letters is really the critters in Congress. And again, I think we're extremely bipartisan. We're not talking about any one party or any one candidate or one senator or one member of the House, but really collectively we're addressing all of them, because it is their collective decisions that make policy for our nation. So while Dr. Benaroya talks about a possible change in the administration, there might also be changes in Congress that see the world differently, that understand, and this is one of the points we make, although, you know, I've been told I'm politically in denial for making this point, but we could actually have people in Congress that understand the difference between an investment and an expense. And such leadership, such vision could actually come from either party or maybe even an independent voice not associated with a party. And we don't really care about parties. We just care about the end result. Guys, let me see if we can't gel this down a little bit. Why would each of you say we have chosen space as a path to recovery? Recovery is my word, because I think, you know, right now we are still in a recovery period of opportunity. We haven't gone so low or so backwards or into so many problems that we can't recover with just a little bit of effort. At least that's how I see it. Chaim, why don't you go first? Since we're all on cell phones here, we don't want to talk over each other. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, we all come to space as being something that we think can grow our economy, but it's more than growing our economy. And I think what we're trying to do is to learn from the history of the modern space program since the Kennedy administration. And we all know what the results were of that space effort, regardless of the fact that Apollo was really a national defense kind of program in a sense. But we saw the results of Apollo. We saw the huge spike in Americans and people overseas going into engineering and science, but mainly Americans. And most of them did not end up in a space program, but they ended up seeding all the companies and national labs that did high-level research. So we see what happens when you have a major space program. And we think that the space, because it's something that transcends all sectors of the economy, it's not just aerospace engineering. It's biology, it's medicine, it's computers, it's sociology, it's human physiology, it's everything. And we think that, and this is based on historical evidence, that a modest investment by the government in creating a long-term program would have wide and positive implications for all segments of our society.
Chaim, in your book, I think it's Turning Lunar Dust into Gold or close to that, you actually have a chart on how many PhDs evolved out of the work done on the early space program in Apollo. I should have asked you to have that chart handy, but do you recall what the numbers look like as a result of our space program?
Right. The numbers were thousands per year, and there were three curves on that. One was the curves of spending on Apollo, and the second and third curves were the added number of people pursuing PhD in engineering, physics, and mathematics. And they all paralleled the spending on Apollo. It went up with Apollo, and it went down with Apollo. And I believe, David, that you may have put it on your blog or website when we last talked about that book.
Yeah, from the last program we were on a couple of months ago. Were you able to see what happens now that space is more, I don't know what the right word would be, more docile? has our have we dropped off in higher education in these same fields?
Well, one thing we know in higher education, this is true for many years, is that the majority of our graduate students are not American-born, and there'd be no problem with that if they came here to stay and become Americans, but most of them will go back over to their home countries and improve the competitiveness of that country. And so we're basically spending, in many cases, tax dollars to educate people who will compete with us down the road. I do see also, looking at the undergraduates in engineering, that as soon as you tell them that you're doing something related to space, whether it's a lunar base or space exploration or designing rockets, that's really what they're interested in, and they become very motivated, and that's why they want to become engineers, because of that. So clearly, our technical students have tremendous interest in space and space exploration. And I would also maintain that most individuals in this country, if you sat with them and talked to them one-to-one, would, after a short conversation, understand it's so important for us.
John, is it worth to spend public money to get people to go to school?
I believe it is. It's in the national interest. To reinforce much of what Haim has been saying from a slightly different viewpoint, this year represents the 40th anniversary of Apollo 17. That was the last human mission to the moon. And most of the people in our country today are not 40 years old. So they don't have any direct experience of the excitement that the lunar program provided, especially up through the first couple of lunar landings. It was enormous. And as Haim said, a lot of people went into various science and technical fields because they were motivated to do so by the excitement of the space program, and then they contributed to the economy. So, in effect, what we are doing now by educating people in the sciences, most of whom are foreign-born, and as Haim said, tend to go back to their countries of origin, is we are burning our own seed capital and educating our future competitors. And there's a huge lag time in producing scientific and technical people, in that the process takes on the order of a decade to take somebody from an active interest in science, entering a university, and getting to the point where they have a good technical education and they can go out and do exciting things. I might also mention, although everybody gets bored and yawns when they hear about spinoffs, but David, a couple of years ago we did a show not only on the health spinoffs of space technology, but on women's health specifically. And there were a lot of spinoffs from the human space program that have directly benefited women's health. And that seems to be a little bit of a mini issue these days again amongst the politicians as they use it to score talking points against one another. But there are enormous benefits. I've seen economic analyses from some years ago that suggested that the dollar-for-dollar return on the U.S. economy was well over 10 and closer to 15 to 1 for the dollars spent on the space program.
Yeah, it depends on what they're spending it on, but certainly in technology,
right,
and medical and miniaturization, the returns have been phenomenal. Listeners, you can call us 1-866-687-7223, even if you have not yet had time to read the two letters that are on the blog. Here's your first email question, and this is Jay, who is in Houston, Texas. And Jay said, I haven't yet read the letters on the blog. What is the crossroads you're talking about? Who wants to deal with that?
How about I take a stab at it?
Okay.
The crossroads is very simple. We can either stagnate and involute and turn into a third world country, or we could have essentially unlimited economic growth and change the current morale of the United States from a rather negative unhappy morale to a conscious recognition of the fact that we can be technical leaders of the world again, and that leadership can improve everybody's lot on the planet.
And space does this?
I believe it does.
Chaim, what the crossroads to you?
I would agree with John. Space, I think, is in basically recreating the sense of society from what we have today, which is really fairly negative about America in the sense that we don't compete, we don't have manufacturing. Many people believe that we hardly manufacture in this country, but yet we're still the largest manufacturer in the world. So there's a lot of negative feelings because of the sharp political climate. Space is, I think, uniformly viewed as a very positive vision of the future, and that would trickle to all these sectors of society, and the United States, for example, making a major space effort, whether it's like the moon or Mars or something else of equal magnitude, I think that just the general mood of the society would improve. And as John said, we're seeing basically a shutting down of NASA in the past few years, and even in the previous administration, even though there was a policy, it was the return to the moon was always underfunded. So again, as you said, as David said, this is not a political issue. This is something that we believe people from all political parties can support because it benefits everybody in our society. And I think one of the major downfalls in the current policy of shutting down Constellation and some of the Mars probes and the shuttle is that a lot of highly technical people that serviced those industries and did the research and built the rockets are going to be, or if they haven't already, are going to be laid off, and they're not going to be around to pass on their knowledge to the next generation. And again, as John said, 10 years from start to finish to get a PhD in engineering or mathematics or physics to become productive, you know, that means that you get two per generation or so, and we're basically losing generations of them as we're shutting down the civilian sector of our space program.
Now, listeners, for those of you who haven't read the articles, lest you think we're advocating a big government unfettered program like Apollo was, that is not the case. And we're not recommending or suggesting a return to the Apollo era. We, in both our open letter as well as the Crossroads op-ed piece, we are making the case for very strong private sector and entrepreneurial development and pretty much taking over low Earth orbit, and NASA in a sense being reformatted to do cutting edge research and technology and exploration and push the edge way out there, similar to what you've heard from a lot of guests on the space show as well as what you've read from others. So we're very much supportive, again, terrific grammar there, of a private entrepreneurial commercial space program side by side in harmony with a very strong civil and robust program, but this requires economic oriented growth systems. It doesn't require regulations that hamstring and restrict commerce, and so we talk about an unfettered sort of regulatory environment to foster economic growth and really constructive policy decisions, both on the private as well as on the civil side. So I would urge you to read what we wrote, because we're not suggesting a return to the Apollo era by any means, but we recognize the importance of what that era did for the country. And we think that mood, the way the country was behaving back then, if it can't be recaptured as a clone, it can certainly be recaptured to the point of improving our national attitude and disposition and levels of confidence over where we are today, for sure. Guys, we also talked about recognizing competing visions for the future for the United States. And And there are competing visions, many of which don't even include space. Chaim, you want to talk about how we addressed the fact that we acknowledge there are competing visions? We did say that they're not all equal, but how did we distinguish space from some of the other competing visions?
Well, there are many competing visions for the future of America. We viewed space as one that is apolitical and can have a tremendous benefit to society. And as you just said, having both the federal government aspect, a NASA approach to space, in parallel and complementing the private sector, we basically feel that eventually the private sector will take over much of space, just as it did with commercial satellites and with other technologies where government was the primary investor. We feel that any positive competing vision, and any positive vision of the future, really has to have space as part of it. It's a very future-oriented, outward-looking activity, and it's a very positive activity. And we think that, as you said earlier, that space really can have a very positive impact on the whole of society, not just engineers, not just astronomers, but it can lend a positive atmosphere to any activity that we see in our society.
John, what's your thought on competing visions for the U.S.?
Well, first of all, I believe that space has to be an important component of any positive vision that leads to positive results. Many of your listeners are familiar with the concept of the zero-sum game. And what we are doing in our society today, particularly with the bickering between various factions in the Congress and between Congress and the White House and between Congress and whatever, is basically we're looking at a zero-sum game with the idea that the only way I can get more of the pie is to take it away from somebody else. And the secret is to grow the pie instead. And space technology and development was a proven way of doing that. Now, you can say, well, the private sector can do it, but except for a very few entrepreneurial spirits in the private sector, space is not going to be developed very effectively in the long term by a purely private enterprise. And the reason for that is that commercial companies have to answer to their shareholders, the people that actually own the company. If you own a share of the XYZ Corporation and there's 100 million shares out there, you own 100 millionth of the company. And in order to respond to the needs of shareholders, most companies cannot invest in high-risk, long-term investments unless they see a pretty positive payout at the end. So I would argue that the role of the federal government is to provide long-term leadership and set long-term goals and perhaps provide some seed money for some of the very risky ventures where the commercial outcomes are not clear until they become clear. And then after that, the private sector can take the developments and various segments of the programs that would evolve and run with them to their own benefit and that of their shareholders.
So what do you say, I mean, to people? I mean, there are so many visions out there, and we hear them all the time. I mean, you know, Occupy Wall Street wasn't out there chanting for a vision of America, you know, for a space program that's different. I mean, they probably don't even want a space program. I don't know. I've never talked to any of them. I haven't heard the Tea Party, for the most part, out there championing you know, let's have a more robust Tea Party, a more robust space program, other than one of the Tea Party organizations called Tea Party in Space, run by Andrew. We're, you know, the vocal level of competing visions really drowns out any of us. I don't mean just the three of us, but us meaning the broader space community. We're totally drowned out. I mean, even Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's been getting lots and lots of coverage for his new book, and again, he was on Bill Maher the other night for a full hour talking about the space program and NASA and the budget. And it's lost in this shuffle of a competing vision of what is projected or supposedly fair for all Americans.
That's because of a logical flaw of the zero-sum game, where the only way you can do this or that for some very vocal segment of the population is to take it away from somebody else.
Well,
and that's not the way it works.
Well, that's what I criticize and we talk about all the time with the word sustainable, which is why I offer to send people Howard Bloom's 2005 speech on sustainability when he gave that speech at Yale University, because the approach we have been undergoing for a long, long time is to divide a shrinking pie among more and more competing entities, and we encourage more and more to compete for that shrinking pie. We don't encourage to increase the size of the pie. At least I don't see it happening that way. Haim?
Yeah, I agree. I think that this is a very important point that has been lost today in our political deliberations, is that in order to improve everybody's economic well-being, you can't do it by taking from one group and giving it to the other. You have to grow the pie. You know, this debate has been going on since Malthus, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. At that time, they said that that the population couldn't grow much beyond what it was at that time. Obviously, now we're probably 10 times the population on Earth. One can't predict where scientific research and engineering development will take our society. There are major inventions that change everything all of a sudden overnight. The transistor, rocket flight, the telephone, all these things change everything overnight. And to assume that we can make policy and grow the economy in a static way basically doesn't work. And so the goal is to enlarge the pie. And historically, I think most people know instinctively that doing research basically grows that pie. It makes it larger, and more people can eat better, more people have better health care, they live in better homes. So all these things come from research and development, and not viewing society and the economy we have today as a static thing.
Absolutely. We have an email that was posted to the blog. And by the way, for those of you that are outside the United States and you don't have toll-free access and you want the direct dial number for our toll-free line number, if you email me, I will send that to you. And Phil, if you're listening still, I am about to send... I'm about to read your blog comment on air, and I believe I sent you the wrong telephone number to call, because I know there's no toll-free numbers coming out of Canada for the most part to the United States. Here is what Phil said. So, Phil, if you do want to call in, email me, and I'll get the right number. I'm sorry for the mix-up. So this is what he posted on the blog. And by the way, listeners, you can send email directly to the show, as you always do, or you can post your email question on the blog, either one. In the first letter, the three of you write, quote, "Our space activities elevated our national spirit and grew our economy to global leadership," end quote. I agree to an extent with the first claim, although we know there were more than a few people critical of the efforts and funding devoted at the time to placing a person on the lunar surface. How true, however, is the latter part of the sentence? Was the Apollo program truly a significant driver of the economy 45 years ago, or was it more of an effect, an activity enabled by a wealthy, militarized, and globally significant world power? Boy, there's a lot of noise on one of your cell phones, let me tell you, so somebody's really breathing heavy or something. Apollo would not have been possible in the 60s if it had not been for the already existing military and industry infrastructure that had been developed over the many decades before. So I ask, if Apollo had not happened, would America and the world look much different today? Chaim, why don't you lead off with that? I know he's got a lot of questions there. It's a long set of questions.
Yeah, and I understand the point that basically he's saying that Apollo piggybacked on American military-industrial complex.
Yeah, and that a lot of people didn't really support it even at the time.
Yeah, and that's true. And it's certainly true that Apollo succeeded in less than a decade because a lot of the technology had already been thought about. But a lot of the technology had not been thought about, and a lot of it was new. And a lot of the benefit of Apollo to society, even to this day, is because of the efforts made to send people into space and have them survive. And so a lot of the medical technology, a lot of our understanding of human beings came from trying to understand how to keep humans alive if we send them in a rocket into space. And I would say that the benefits are more than just the technology that we got from Apollo, but also the fact that, you know, for a decade, people felt, I think, very proud of that activity. It was an ennobling activity, and it was something that I think motivated a lot of people to take up, as you mentioned earlier, the long study that's required to become an engineer or a scientist. So I think that we would be a lot different. And there have been articles that as John referred to earlier, that did economic studies on the expenditures of Apollo and the return to the society at large. And there have been studies of anywhere from from a multiple of 7 to local multiples in some cities of up to 25. So I don't think that those who benefited from that multiple, from those multiples in different parts of the country, would be the same today at all. And I think there's also, as Kennedy said in one of his speeches, by doing things that are very hard, we're basically tackling areas of technology and other aspects. For example, just the management of the space program required new management types of techniques that eventually evolved into other large organizations. So there are many things that are quantifiable, but I think there are also the things that just made people proud and wanting to get involved in that.
John, your comment?
Well, I agree with what Chaim has been saying, and would just point out that there were a lot of synergisms back and forth between the Cold War and the technologies that led to the Apollo program and the human spaceflight program. But remember, the early part of the U.S. spaceflight program did involve uncrewed vehicles because we did not have the missile throw weight that would allow putting a person into orbit until the Atlas came along. And prior to that, with the Thor, the Polaris, and the original Jupiter, there was not enough throw weight to put somebody into orbit. So there were synergisms, there's no question about it, and they played off of one another. And legacy technologies from military applications that allowed the acceleration of the process for something like Apollo. But remember, we're not really advocating a return to the Apollo program or some mutant variation of the Apollo program. We're talking about changing policies to allow something to evolve that gets us away from this zero-sum game mentality that we have and allows expansion of our economy at a very vigorous pace.
What about the last part of his question? I've often thought about this. If we had never gone to the moon, what would our space program have evolved to? What would it have evolved to in other countries like Russia, China, and so forth. And the opportunity cost, would we have developed the spinoffs anyway? Would they have looked different? Would our society be as it is today or similar? Or would do you think we'd look radically different if we had not had our early space program?
Well, my opinion is that the world would look quite a bit different today because the rest of the world looked to the United States as the technological leaders, the winners of the Cold War, if you will, and an example of what a capitalistic society can do as opposed to a centrally controlled socialistic society by going to the moon. I mean, that provided a focal point. Communication satellites were being developed and probably would have continued to evolve into something approaching what we have today, but it would not have occurred at the rate at which it did because of the focus that was provided by saying, okay, we are going to put somebody on the moon and bring them back. And that provided a focal point for a lot of the development.
Chaim, how do you think we would end up looking if we didn't have this early space program and going to the moon?
I think I agree with John that some of these technologies may have evolved maybe slightly different, but definitely slower. I think one can, you know, one hears the argument sometimes that instead of spending $15 billion a year on NASA, to spend that money doing research. And while there would be benefits from that, research always does better when it's focused on a task and under a tight fiscal and time deadline. And that's one of the issues and one of the difficulties of the current space program is that there's no real focus, there's no real goal in mind for what we're spending essentially the same money on as we did before Constellation was canceled. But I think, as John said, there were political ramifications from Apollo and the fact that the United States was able to marshal huge resources and huge talent and within a decade get people to the moon safely and back home safely. And I think there were political repercussions to that are hard to quantify, but there were many people in many countries for whom that effort signaled the advantages of a capitalist and free economy and how much can be done in that sort of freedom.
An email question from Phil, and by the way, listeners, again, the number, if you want to call us, and remember, there is no break today, so don't put off calling on the idea that, I'll call after we come back from break, which many of you do. There simply is no break, and we are ending on time today. 1-866-687-7223. Phil is in Alexandria, Virginia. He says, this is for any of the three of you, or for all of you, how do you rationalize spending any public money on space when so many people are hurting, losing their homes, having severe problems, out of work, medical expenses are rising as they are, now we can't even afford to fill our gas tanks up to get to work, assuming we have a job, and here you guys are advocating that the path to prosperity is going through space and spending billions of dollars on something related to space. So how do you justify or rationalize this, and what do you say to that segment of society that is really hurting and would rather see and feel better about getting some of the federal budget thrown its way to help them face the realities of the economy that we are all suffering through? Who wants to go first?
I guess I can go first.
Okay.
I think we all feel for those who are having tremendous difficulties, and certainly there is a safety net that helps people get through these difficult times. But I think if we wait for the day when nobody is suffering in society before we do certain things, then we'd still be back, you know, hundreds of years with our technology and with our society. I mean, the fact that technology advances and we can grow food more effectively and that we can create shelters more effectively, that's all a result of somebody putting some money into some research and some activity that was not spent on feeding the poor. But for that reason, then maybe we should also stop on medical research or spend money on museums, on the arts, and just put that into food programs. I would say that would be certainly a downward spiral for any society that did that.
John, do you want to comment on this?
I do. This comes back to your favorite phrase of there is a difference between an expense and an investment. And we look at spending, if you will, in the space program, if it's done intelligently, to be an investment in the future as opposed to simply an expense. You can always just pour money into a hole. And I would also point out that there are a lot of people hurting, and food prices are going up, energy prices are going up, costs of medical care is going up, unemployment is going up, and a lot of that was created by, in my opinion, this zero-sum mentality that we have been suffering from over the past couple of decades. And I would think if we can get away from that and start looking at really investing in things that grow the economy as opposed to just slapping one Band-Aid on top of another in order to get through the next election cycle, we will be far better off. From the standpoint of medical care, there are statistics out there that say that some huge fraction of lifetime medical expenses, something like 70 or 80%, typically occur in the last 6 months of life. And so there is, for a growing segment of the population, if you look at our demographics in the United States, an essentially infinite demand for medical care. And if we keep paying for it, instead of working smarter to solve some of those issues related to medical care, we will eventually bankrupt ourselves just caring for the demands given current medical technology rather than developing new and more effective technologies.
So what do you do, not fund someone for medical care in the last 6 months of their life?
No, but you spend some fraction of the overall effort on research to improve the quality of medical care and to work smarter. I mean, right now, there are a lot of things that can be done to improve the likelihood of people getting past coronary artery disease without incurring gigantic expenses. Angioplasties, for example, came along, and they were a heck of a lot cheaper than doing coronary artery bypass surgical procedures, and a lot less invasive as well. So those techniques, those kinds of approaches, medical approaches, pharmacological approaches, driving down cholesterol levels in people with established coronary artery disease and things like that can relatively inexpensively vastly improve the quality of life.
You have another email question from Bethany, and Bethany says she is in Oklahoma City. I've read your two letters on the website. I notice in the second one, where you're talking about your open letter, you're unwilling to just throw money at NASA, but you suggested creating yet another government oversight and regulatory agency to have power over space policy to apparently do a better and a more efficient job at whatever space policy will unfold than what NASA does. Aren't you really just adding more bureaucracy to an already overloaded, bloated bureaucracy? Won't this actually make the matter worse rather than better?
Not if it's done properly. And there are agencies within the government that appear to spend money intelligently. I would suggest the National Science Foundation is one example. The Nuclear Regulatory Agency, believe it or not, is another example. And the National Institutes of Health. And what they do is those organizations do have congressional oversight. And if they don't satisfy Congress, they
will suffer the consequences. But they have a budget provided by Congress, and then by and large, the agencies figure out at a lower level how to spend the money, and they get out from under that constant political process under the full glare of the 24-hour news cycle and the like, and they do a pretty good job from the standpoint of most observers. Now, the other side of that, of course, is that a lot of people, especially in academics, don't like the idea of congressional earmarks that sort of bypass the standard processes for funding research and development activities by these scientific organizations, unless it's, of course, their port coming their way. But that's something that we have to get away from, and the constant micromanagement of Congress is, in my opinion, just plain silly, and it's also a huge waste of money.
I would just add to that in addition, these agencies are able to fund long-term projects. And, for example, National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, they don't fund year to year. Many times they'll fund something over a period of 5 years. And a lot of the inefficiencies and waste of NASA comes from this year-to-year haggling with Congress and with things like we've just seen with every change in administration gets a change in long-term space policy. And there's no way to succeed efficiently in that kind of political environment.
So thinking, I'm being the devil's advocate now, thinking that another agency formed by Congress has this new power for space, does this need the approval of NASA, or does it only require congressional approval? What would be the process to do something like this?
Well, I would think NASA would be part of the process of figuring out what would make sense. You'd need to have people both within the space program, perhaps the commercial space sector, some of these other agencies that have learned how to manage large funding programs. NIH has a bigger budget, I believe, than NASA does.
Yes.
I think just being able to get the best thoughts on this, you know, the government and panels. We've had excellent panels. We had a panel that studied the Challenger disaster and came up with a lot of ideas that changed the way the shuttle program worked. So certainly, people from NASA, there are plenty of very smart people in NASA that could provide insights that are useful. But I think it's certainly not impossible to create such an agency with the net benefit of actually reducing management costs rather than increasing them.
Of course, we have panels and then nobody pays attention to them. Think of the deficit reduction panel, and Augustine had some good ideas, and you know, the list goes on and on. You could probably go through government agencies for the past three decades and find really well-meaning panels that gather dust on a shelf someplace.
Hopefully, space will have a broader support structure where it's not viewed as political. I think some of these other things have been more politicized. Space is not as politicized, and maybe something can be done where everybody's on board, both the president, the Congress, and the people who work on this stuff.
Here's another email. I guess we're not pulling in the phone calls. Maybe people are still at work. I don't know. But again, the toll-free number is 866-687-7223. Harry is in New York City, and he says, I'm curious as to who you guys think your target market is, who your audience is. Are you looking for young people who seem to be disenchanted? I read recently where Ron Paul had such a huge crowd at the University of California at Berkeley to hear him. They had to move him to a different location on campus to accommodate hundreds, if not thousands, of more people, mostly young college students. Is that your audience, or are you talking to aging old guys like yourselves who remember the glory days of Apollo, and you want it back? Or are you talking to the people who did go out to Occupy Wall Street, or who do go to Tea Party meetings? Or are you trying to reach members of Congress that don't even seem to talk about space? Or are you trying to reach any of the presidential candidates? Who are you really trying to influence and communicate with your two letters?
All the above.
Shotgun approach?
Well, you know, it's not really, we don't see, I don't think any of us see space as like a special interest. It's not something that if it goes forward, any of us benefit financially or see it as a political win. We really see space as something of benefit both to the young people. We see it as a benefit to the industrial base of the United States across disciplines, not just high tech. And we see it something as a very positive thing to every citizen of this country. So all of the above, everybody has to be on board in order for this kind of transformation to succeed. And whenever we've been able to do that, then we've seen great strides in what we can do in this country.
John?
I'd just like to say, as one of those aging old guys, I'm not pining for the good old days of Apollo. I'm pining for something that can be different and new and exciting. And I believe that we have to reach out to essentially all groups. We have problems with STEM education, you know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics in our country that are quite severe. We have declining interest in those fields. There are plenty of young people who are part of our target audience. Most kids, if you look at them as elementary school kids, they're excited by the concept of space flight. Where does that disappear? How does it disappear? What can be done to maintain it or maintain an interest in science that evolves from that? As far as talking to people like the Occupy Wall Street movement, again, I would submit that that's because of the logical error of playing the zero-sum game instead of looking at investment in space, if it's spent intelligently, will provide a way of growing the economy, and then that will allow more affordability for a lot of things, including helping the people who are falling into the safety nets that are provided today.
Okay, guys, so what I haven't told you, even though I've been talking to you for the past 2 weeks, are some of the experiences that I forced myself to undergo while being in Los Angeles for 8 or 9 days with my son, who was in the USC hospital. So when I had the opportunity, I spoke to his peers, his friends that were in the room visiting from time to time. They're late 20s, early 30s. I spoke to quite a few of the nurses and the staff. And so we're talking about all highly educated, highly trained people who are in a very unique, specialized university teaching hospital. We're not talking about nurses' aides and you know, the lower level of the healthcare provision. I mean, these are really technical people, from, you know, surgical nurses, lung nurses. I mean, they're all highly, highly specialized. So they have an education. So across the board, there's not much interest in space other than it's cool. And they like sci-fi movies, you know, for sure. Many of them have watched all the classics. Others just, you know, just like it. They like Star Trek or something like that. They are more focused across the board, and maybe this is Los Angeles more so than any other thing, on saving the climate. They all have, whether the listeners out there buy global warming or not, and we need to save the climate, that's not the issue. Across the board, almost everyone I talk to has a priority of saving Earth's climate. Number two, a priority of going green and stopping using fossil fuels. Before I ever brought up space to anybody, I asked them about how they prioritize the issues and what they would like to see government doing for the future. And space doesn't enter into it. And I probably talked to 50 people, which I know is a ridiculously small sample size. But space doesn't enter into it. But when I interject space, oh, yeah, it's cool, and they like it, but it's not part of their solution consciousness to anything. So we can sit here and say they're dumb or they're stupid or they don't have an education. None of that is true. They're all college graduates. Some of them have graduate degrees. This is what I found universally across the board, you know, while down there. And again, 50 people doesn't make a sample size. But space is not showing up as a solution to people. And when we talk about it, it's ho-hum because they don't have any – they have no verification coming to them from any other sources. Okay, so they listen to a space show program or they hear Neil deGrasse Tyson on Bill Maher. But a day later, it's all forgotten because they are constantly reminded that they have to save the planet. They are constantly reminded that we have to have green and alternative energy and get off of fossil fuels. There isn't that constant nagging voice, for lack of a better way of saying it, that says, solution A, make a right turn at the crossroads and go through space. Nobody hears that. And when they do hear it, it's a one-time only hearing it, and then they move on to, we got to save the planet, we got to be green, we got to do this or that. I don't think that our papers are going to really make an impression and reach this crowd, and I think this crowd is pretty indicative of the general population in America. One of you guys can comment on it if you want.
Who first?
John, you go first.
Well, David, first of all, you were down in a large teaching hospital associated with a very large medical school, and I'm willing to bet that if you ask 50 nurses there where DEXA came from, you'd get a blank look. And if you said it came out of the space program, you'd get a really blank look. That is something that needs to be addressed. And the only way I can see to do it is to keep talking about the issues.
Look, the doctors I met wouldn't know where it came from. Are you kidding? I've already tried that with doctors before. They don't know its origin or the origin of bisphosphonates.
I know. That's a problem. And as far as sustainability and saving the planet and all of that, what do you think the end result would be of increasing our knowledge by orders of magnitude on how to maintain closed life support systems? Do you think that would add to problems of pollution on the Earth in terms of sewage recovery and treatment, in terms of overall pollution? Or do you think it would make things better? I would like to argue that it would most likely improve the sustainability of our living on the Earth.
Yeah, but the point I'm trying to make it is we may impress them with what we're saying, but it's a one-time-only impression because they're not getting it in their daily messages from however they get their messages, but the sustainability, the zero-sum game, the green, the alternative fuels, the this or the that, that is a daily, reoccurring, nonstop message that they have been bombarded with, many of them since middle school.
That's because we have not been pounding that message for several decades now, but have been quiet and not expressing our opinions and what some might think is a little bit of wisdom about what can be gained. We grew up at a time when the older people were always talking about the excitement and the growing future allotted by spaceflight, whether it was on the Disneyland TV shows or in popular magazines or for example, the 1962 World's Fair had all kinds of things about
space,
developing space technology and the future of space flight and this and that. And now we don't have that as we're sort of collectively diving into our navels. And the only way I can see to change it is to start talking about it at some point.
But my God, there's no shortage, I said this in the introduction, of really great ideas and solutions and programs and suggestions. I mean, Rick Tumlinson publishes his great article, you know, for the private sector. Mike Griffin does. Scott, I mean, we could just go down the list. There's no shortage of people putting out the kind of space message that we're talking about. For some reason, getting it out there on par with these other messages that people have been bombarded with since middle school days, going back, you know, 2-3 decades, seems to be really uphill. I mean, Chaim, you're in front of students every single day. Comments on any of what I've observed and what John is talking about?
Yeah, you both make very good points. I think part of the problem is that even though good articles are being published, they're in a very narrow range of publications. You mentioned Bill Maher with deGrasse Tyson. That's a rare example where the media has talked about it, and then it's usually as part of a running gag. And we saw what happened to Newt Gingrich when he talked about going to the moon. So that's another example where it's not really viewed as a serious policy thing. But I think, you know, this problem has been coming on for decades. It's not going to be solved by our two articles being published or thousands of these articles being published. I think it's something that has to work its way into the school system. And I would also say that your sample that it was 50 wasn't a bad thing, but it was basically a uniform population, meaning these are all people with the same backgrounds that were answering your questions. And I think if you had those same 50 spread around, you might have had a slightly different answer. But nevertheless, there's still a problem. People don't see space as a solution. They see it more like science fiction. I think that one of the problems by looking at it as science fiction is that the science fiction that we see in the movies is something that we won't see in space for hundreds of years. So what we can do in space is always a couple of orders of magnitude less difficult than what we can do, you know, in the science fiction. But I think it's a perpetual thing that this has to be done. You know, it has to be put out there. We have to talk to elementary school kids. We have to talk to college kids. And it really is a long-term thing. There's no silver bullet, as is commonly said these days.
How do we encourage others to argue, and I'm not talking about among themselves, but to argue publicly, to take the debate, to take the message to Congress, to a general audience, to open letters or whatever, against this zero-sum game? Because, as you said, our letters, the amount of impact any one person or group of people have is probably, you know, really minor, to say the most. Unless you hit on the magic silver bullet words that revolutionize everything, how do you increase the argument so that it becomes the mainstream rather than, oh, it's just a voice in the wilderness crying out?
That's a difficult question to answer because it has to happen on many levels. It has to happen through our educational system. It has to happen in the mass media. Didn't CNN used to have a space reporter, a science reporter? I don't think
Miles O'Brien, and they canned the department. Miles is still doing great reporting.
ABC News used to have a science reporter, and I think all the main media had science reporters, and they would basically bring things to light. Now you don't really have it. You don't really have it. Even though there are a lot of space websites, you don't go there unless you're interested in it in the first place. So it has to be something that's done on many levels: education, public policy, dealing with congressmen, and it has to be something that is just part of our society.
Okay, so here's another thought, and listeners, for those of you that haven't read our article, we do talk about the track record of space, and when you have a track record, it is, while the past is not an indicator or a guarantor of the future, it is a strong indicator of the value or benefits or the problems, depending on what the track record shows. So the track record for space development and exploration in both of our letters is clearly stated and is clearly positive. I think people might want to argue that it's not a positive track record, but I think that would be easily refuted. When you talk about the zero-sum game stuff, John, there really isn't a bona fide track record to back up that kind of policy. And so shouldn't just by the natural order of common sense, assuming there is such a thing, space with a proven, verifiable, validated track record for all of what our economy needs today, it should be a slam dunk.
Only if everybody talks about it. And all we can do as individuals is talk about it one person at a time. Every time you encounter somebody, talk about space. And I might mention the space advocacy community on its own has another problem, and that's the internecine squabbling and the lack of civility. And as you know, that's a favorite theme of mine. And that, I believe, has to stop, too.
And by the way, listeners, we do cross many different platforms and concepts and theories in our letters, but we're not, even when we talk about competing visions, we're not squabbling and being disrespectful to people who hold a competing vision for what they believe America should be like in 10 or 20 years. And I think that that's very, very important if you're out to win friends and convince some enemies that maybe you have some valid points. So we don't go off into the squabbling world at all. We try to, you know, keep it peaceful, but that's probably the wrong word. But harmonious, I guess, is what we're trying to do.
Respectful. We're respectful.
What guys am I failing to talk about regarding our two articles and what we would like to see from this audience?
I think we need to avoid seeking a magic bullet or a silver bullet, as you brought up, and I think that needs to be emphasized a little more strongly, perhaps. There is no real silver bullet that any of us have been able to come up with, and I don't think anybody else has come up with a silver bullet for solving this. It's just a matter of grinding away.
Chaim?
I agree with that.
Hold on, we're getting a lot of grinding noise, so to speak. Say it again, please, Chaim.
I think we need to find some way to address the issues that we've just been talking about. How do we make this part of the national dialogue at all levels? You know, how do we make state legislatures, county colleges, elementary schools, K-12? How do we have that as part of the national dialogue, as we have many other issues part of the national dialogue? Because what we're talking about is publishing one in a paper and another one possibly distributing it to legislatures and the Congress and the president. But we need more than that, because that kind of stuff is already being done. So as good as what we may write be, there's been others that are equally good, and they haven't really broken that barrier. So I think communicating it to a wide variety of people at all levels is really a critical aspect of some success.
Here's another comment that was sent to the blog, so that's fine, as long as I'm getting it during the showtime. So this is Terry in Corpus Christi, Texas. I believe, like everyone else on this topic, NASA needs constant funding. I hate to be negative. I think we will be lucky to keep funding at the current rate. I'm afraid it will be a zero-sum game for some time to come. This country never has made big decisions without our backs to the wall. FDR had to strain with all his will to fight the Nazis in World War II. A large portion of the country wanted peace. Apollo came about because of the shock of the Russian success in space. Americans didn't feel like leaders in the world anymore. The politics of this country is broken. Even a non-political statement is met 5 minutes later with a blistering attack from the other party. I'm afraid NASA will have more cuts in the future. Commercial space could lose all funding to help support SLS and James Webb, of which I hope never happens. So any of you want to comment on his optimistic view of the future?
I think he identified the problem. And all we can do is say that that's not the optimal approach for the United States, and we need to start looking at planning ahead a little bit instead of operating only when our backs are to the wall. And as far as our backs coming to the wall,
A hypothetical question would be, what would happen if we found a mile-wide hunk of rock heading to the Earth in, say, 20 years or 30 years? And that's completely hypothetical. Would we be able to do anything about it? Would we be able to marshal the forces necessary to do anything about it? Or we'd just sit here and basically do what the dinosaurs did?
Well, I would like to think that we would be able to do something about it, but who knows? Chaim, do you have any thoughts on what Terry said?
Well, I think you know, he has a lot of points that are valid, and we have worked best when our backs are to the wall. So another question one could ask is, what would it take to recreate the drive that created Apollo? Is it China? You know, sending a probe that lands on the moon? Is it something where we feel that it becomes obvious that we really have trailed in that? I think the problem is that the decline that we're going to have in aeronautics and astronautics and space is going to be a gradual decline. It's not going to be such an obvious thing that all of a sudden we realize it. We'll realize it all of a sudden when somebody does something that we can't match, and then we're 10 years behind them at that point.
Well, nothing seems to have motivated society or Congress yet to enhance policy in some way. And, you know, whether it would take another Cold War or something drastic, I really don't know. I would like to think we could be motivated just like entrepreneurial self-starters are motivated, but I realize they're just a small fraction of the population that can behave like that and achieve something. So maybe we're hardwired to only be able to do great things in face of adversity. I don't know.
Part of the problem also is that the large problems that society has now are so overwhelming, and if we talk, we link it back to what we were just talking about, that space is not viewed as a solution. So people are looking for solutions to the problems that we have now, and space isn't one of them. And that's the unfortunate thing, because everything that we know and your listeners know, David, is space is a solution to a lot of the issues. We're looking for things to grow the economy, create jobs. Space over a long period of time can do that. Unfortunately, it's been mismanaged since the last of the Apollo era, and it's done some good things, but it hasn't really lived up to its promise.
What do we want from the listeners regarding, you know, feedback, comments? What would make each of you happy, thinking we had communicated successfully to those who have heard the show today and who will hear it when it gets archived? Chaim, you go first.
Well, it would be great to know if the listeners, after they read our two essays, can tell us both things that they agree with as well as things they disagree with. So if you think that a certain paragraph is really great and makes a good point, then let us know that. And then perhaps you can make suggestions where you think we've fallen short. You know, is a paragraph missing the point? So the more specificity, then the better that we can incorporate the listeners' input.
And by the way, listeners, we know there are a couple of minor typos and intense glitches that passed our oversight and proofreading. So all of that is obviously going to be corrected after we finish that. You don't need to call that to our attention. But I think that is a good and reasonable expectation, Chaim. John, do you have a different set of expectations?
I'd just like to see useful feedback that we can use to improve the effectiveness of our communications. And if people want to suggest some alternative approaches, for example, one blogger suggested that we rename the open letter to the politicians and send it to the president and to the relevant members of Congress. We can do that. We've already decided we're going to send it to our own individual representatives,
as a personal letter from the three of us. But I think I'm just looking for some useful constructive criticisms to improve the punch and clarify our thinking. Show us where we're right. Show us where we're wrong. And if somebody out there stumbles on the magic bullet, the silver bullet that we've been talking about, which I don't think exists, I would be delighted to be proven wrong and find the silver bullet.
So for my expectations, they include what both of you said, but listeners, I have another expectation. Maybe it's a hope, although I kind of hate to use that word because it's become so politically charged. But I know that there are listeners out there who never, ever contact the space show or me or a guest. And why do I know that? Because I'll be at a conference and somebody will come up to me and say they love to listen to the show. And I have no clue who they are, and I've never heard from them. For example, I know lots and lots of people in the aerospace industry and NASA listen to this program. I know people in government listen to this program. Where are you people? Why don't you send in an email or a comment or post something on the blog? I believe I've got the blog set up where it would take an anonymous post. What my expectation is, because I believe whether we've hit on the right statements for an open letter or policy, I think we've equaled or surpassed many of those that have written things out there. Do we have the best one? Probably not, but we're trying like so many others. I know that many of you could give us – boy, there's a lot of noise on somebody's line. It's unbelievable. I know that there's many of you out there that could give us feedback and information that we simply don't know because we're not in the position that you are in the space industry. And we know that you hear this program. And my expectation is that you contact us. Send in a feedback or a comment. Again, if you do it anonymously, do it under a phony name. I don't care. But we want to hear from, what is it, that silent majority term that used to be around? That's my expectation, that we actually hear from people out there who know what they're talking about, who have the experience, and who are in the different disciplines that make space all that it can be and all that it is. And that's my hope, that's my expectation, that we've reached a few of you and motivated and inspired you enough to send in something to guide and help us with these two different approaches that we're taking. And I guess that's what I want, along with the comments that the two of you have offered. And if you absolutely demand that your identity be protected, we will absolutely honor that. That's not an issue at all. So hopefully many of you will come out of the closet or the woodwork, so to speak, and do just that. Guys, what else? Do you think that there's any chance that we'll see what we're talking about, give or take a percentage, show up as a national topic of debate in the presidential election? I mean, it should be. It's a path to economic prosperity for the country.
Well, it would be nice if somebody can give us the chief advisor to Romney, so we can send him these letters.
Well, I'm going to send them to Scott. He's on the committee, and I'll also send them to Mike, who is on it, and so they'll see it. Whether that means anything or not, I can't tell you.
The other thing I was thinking is if any of you are willing to take.
Hold on, we can't hear you. Wait a minute. There's just so much wind noise or something going on. I haven't been able to figure out what it is. Okay, go ahead now, Chaim.
Yeah, I was going to say if any of your listeners are willing to take one or both of our letters and sign it themselves and give it to their representatives, then we'd be glad to. I think it would be a good thing to distribute it as widely as possible in that way as well.
Yeah, I would say sign it along with our signatures, and just for copyright purposes, but I would be willing to give listeners permission to do that. John, are you up for that?
I am, and I do know one thing, and that is that up to now, we have not formally expressed our opinions in writing, and that was a guarantee that nobody was going to hear our opinions. Now maybe a few people will.
Maybe we will get a different level and a higher quantity of responses, which again goes to the very heart of what I was saying a few minutes ago. By the way, listeners, this has nothing to do with our show today, but when Dwayne Hyland did that program on debating, and I asked him that question about how effective are rants or passionate pleas or something like that on the air. And he was talking about they're really not that effective in persuading people. As an aside, I've been really trying to avoid getting on a soapbox and doing a typical space show rant, although I do get long-winded at times. As an additional set of comments, if any of you think that it's an improvement, that I'm not going hog wild on typical David Livingston rants, let me know. I'm just curious for your opinion on that, and thought I would throw it in there. Guys, we're pretty close to the end of our program. How about checking in for our closing views and closing comments? Dr. Benaroya, you go first this time.
Okay. Well, let me say that I think it's been a valuable experience having these shows. We've had several over the past year and a half, trying to cultivate our views and put it all together into a coherent document that we could send out as sort of a wake-up call. I think it's really crucial that people start talking about this as a solution to part of the problems that we see around us today, and that every voice counts. Every member of the House really wants to hear from their constituents, and I think every voice in that kind of venue has a lot of weight, especially if it's written and mailed in. So I would urge everybody to do their share on that, their fair share, as some politicians say, and support the space program, and put it into their own words that they like. You know, there's certainly enough information out there. There are enough essays written by very smart people. If you believe in this, then put it in your own words, sign it, and walk it over to your member of the House.
Or Senate, yeah.
Or Senate.
John, closing comments from you, please.
Basically, I agree with what Haim said, and the three of us represent some fairly diverse states in this process. David, you're a resident of the largest aerospace state in the United States, at least for the time being. And Haim, you are in a largely industrial state that's very important to our productive economy, and are a full-time faculty member with an active academic career. And I come from a very small state that has a total of three congressional representatives, but I can get my presence in front of all three of them relatively easily, and I intend to take this letter and hand deliver it to all three of them.
Guys, one other thing. There is going to be a closing point, listeners, where if you continue to comment, we will probably have already closed out the drafts, finalized them, and started the distribution process. So I don't know if that's 2 weeks from now or 3 weeks from now or May 1st or whenever that might be. I know some of you listen to archive programs 3 months after the fact, because we do so many programs, or you just don't get around to it, or you're traveling, or who knows what. But there isn't an endless amount of time if you want to comment, and you want your comments considered in how we finalize the paper. Now, I haven't really spoken to my co-authors here as to how much time we want to allow for this process. I don't know that we have a set time. Have either of you guys thought about this? Do you think we need to put a time window on it, like do it within 2 weeks or do it within 3 weeks, or do we just be loosey-goosey and play it by ear? Anybody?
Well, I think we should put some time limit on it just so that we can finish it, get it out there, and start working on other space issues and not be, be endlessly revising.
What do you suggest as a time period, Chaim?
I would say since, you know, tax day is April 15th, and people are going to, or 16th, whatever it is this year, people are going to be busy for a couple of weeks, for a week. Maybe something like mid-May would be give us enough time to let everybody have a chance, and then we can, it will give us free time to integrate.
May 15th or something like that?
Yeah, to me that sounds reasonable.
John, do you have any thoughts on a timeline?
Well, I think that would work. I would tend to lean a little closer to May 1st. Personally,
that'll be fine with me as well. I have no objections with
that. All right, so let's say no later than May 1st, but probably given the way the three of us work together and our own schedules in proofreading and commenting and all of this, you could probably buy May 15th, and we'd still be in the process of proofing and editing. But much past that, you'll probably miss the opportunity to have your comments considered by us, but you certainly will have them on the blog for the whole world to see. So shoot for May 1st. If you're really dragging, you're probably okay by May 15th, because I really drag. I think May 1st is a good deadline, and May 15th is the drop-dead date for sure. Does that work for you guys?
Yeah, sounds fine.
I think that's it, listeners. I want to thank you, those of you who participated with your questions today. And all of us have said over and over again, we certainly look forward to your feedback and comments and constructive suggestions. So have at it. And thank you all for listening to The Space Show. And space does really represent solutions to a lot of the problems that we're in. We need to just help further the word that is a viable path for policymakers to start considering, and a proven path. So I want to thank John and Chaim for being with us, and all of you who participated. Goodbye from today's Monday Space Show program.